boosting creativity and innovation, and bringing about a leap in manufacture and production. This will pave the way for maximum use of capacities in the field of manufacture and production. Moving in this course will result in high and sustainable economic growth, and will also assist in solving the problem of unemployment. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution has pointed out, we have many scientists, specialists, knowledge-based firms and innovative persons in the country, and this is amongst the most important economic infrastructure in every country. It means that the most important economic infrastructure for a country is the existence of a highly skilled and trained manpower.
Around the World with Reporters.
Rome's Association of Palestinians called a sit-in in the vicinity of the Italian Parliament to draw attention on Israel's COVID-19 vaccine program, which excludes the nearly 5 million Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza Strip under Israeli military occupation. The rally was supported by a number of left-wing groups and unions.
The fourth Geneva Convention stipulates that Israel has a responsibility as an occupying power to ensure that medical aid reaches the occupied territories to combat the coronavirus crisis. Responsibilities also include providing vaccines in a non-discriminatory manner to Palestinians under its control.
Israel has the duty to provide COVID vaccines to Palestinians. The question is why nobody talks about it here in Italy. TVs and newspapers praise Israel's vaccination campaign, but they don't say a word about how Israel is a militarized country which is not observing its international obligations and pays each vaccine dose double the price, promising pharmaceutical companies patient data.
While Palestinians' right to health care is undermined, Tel Aviv has pledged to send thousands of spare coronavirus vaccines to foreign allies that have accepted Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem, such as Czech Republic, Hungary and Honduras.
These vaccine donations are the latest example of Israel's new expression of soft power. Tel Aviv rewards or sways those that have little access to vaccines in exchange for their complicity. This confirms the absence of morals and values of Israel.
We are calling on Italy, the EU and international community to take concrete measures to force Israel to provide Palestinians with vaccines. We are not begging, we demand what is ours.
In January, the United Nations voiced its concern over Israel's refusal to vaccinate the Palestinians, but the appeal has gone unheard so far. Max Civili, Rome.
Across South Korea, vaccinations against COVID-19 began, with more than 5,000 nursing home residents and care providers scheduled to get their jabs by the end of the day.
I was thinking of the elderly patients at our nursing home who have been exhausted and sad about not being able to see their families, so I'm glad to be the first person to be vaccinated. I hope herd immunity is established so that our patients can see their families and everyone can return to daily life without masks.
President Moon Jae-in observed people getting their shots, seeking to encourage people to be vaccinated when it's their turn. South Korean officials say the country should achieve herd immunity by November of this year. Herd immunity is achieved when a high percentage of people have been immunized, preventing the spread of a contagious disease. But about half of South Koreans surveyed are hesitant to get their shots. South Korea had been successful in limiting the spread of COVID-19 during the initial outbreak a year ago. but has seen waves of the virus infect hundreds of people each day since November last year.
There are many reasons why I will get my shot right away, but I think during the last year of COVID-19, the government has done well to prevent it spreading, so I trust them in terms of the vaccine.
South Korea has received vaccines, but I'm hesitant to get it. It's because in the UK, many cases of side effects have been reported, so I'm a bit reluctant. I want to watch what happens, and I'll get it if it's okay then.
Seoul's November goal of herd immunity may also be complicated by supply chain challenges and drug-resistant variants of COVID-19, with a return to normality more likely in 2022. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The nursery home in the vicinity of Tehran, and people are waiting to receive the first dose of their COVID-19 jab. At this phase, which is the second, the elderly and those with underlying diseases and the disabled will get the vaccine. The country's health minister, Said Namaki, attended the retirement home in Kahrizak to launch the campaign. He told reporters that these people will be vaccinated free of charge.
Fortunately, today, the second phase of corona vaccination began across the country. At this stage, in addition to people working at the ICUs of the hospitals and the more vulnerable ones, the elderly will get the jab. We launched the campaign here at Kahrizak Nursery Home, but as of tomorrow, at most of the nursery centers, this will continue.
Press TV asked the minister when the normal people will take the vaccine, and he answered that hopefully, by September, most of the Iranians will be vaccinated.
Based on the priorities, first off the healthcare staff and then the elderly and people with specific diseases, as well as those injured during the Iran-Iraq war, will be inoculated. Afterwards, it comes to the normal people, and I think most of the target groups will get the shot by mid-September.
We also interviewed the head of Iran's welfare organization, who told us that in the first stage, some 20,000 doses will be allocated to nursery centers across the country.
Over 14,000 elderly people are receiving services at nursery homes across Iran. Out of them, over 3,000 were infected, but some 2,200 got well, 506 people are under treatment, and unfortunately, 375 ones lost their lives despite our efforts. At this center, 1,400 aged and disabled people will be vaccinated within 2 days.
The Islamic Republic kicked off the first phase of COVID-19 vaccination with administering the jab on medical staff working at some 600 hospitals across the country. Iranian health officials say indigenously produced shots will be used in the later stages of the campaign. Over 110,000 people have been vaccinated up to now. Iran has so far logged more than 1.6 million COVID-19 cases with over 59,800 deaths.
Iran began its COVID-19 vaccination program on February 9th. The top priority group of vaccination are doctors and nurses who are working at intensive care units of the hospitals. The next group are these elderly people and the ones with underlying diseases. Human Abedi, Kahrizak.
Venezuela's Congress, also known as the National Assembly, has requested the government of President Nicolas Maduro to expel European Union Ambassador Isabel Brulianti out of the South American nation as a diplomatic action countering the recently launched sanctions from the EU against the Bolivarian Republic. The Maduro administration has denounced the European measures, describing them as illegal and harmful to the economy of Venezuela. Venezuelan officials say that the EU, along with the U.S. government, are plotting to produce a humanitarian crisis in the Latin American country in order to bring down President Nicolas Maduro. Although a UN human rights envoy recently declared foreign sanctions on Venezuela have no legal basis and must be lifted, the EU has ratified its decision. Venezuelan authorities claim they will legally confront the sanctions.
Okay, van 34 meses.
The EU, just like the US, is criminally targeting Venezuela. However, this unfair aggression will not oust Maduro.
Meanwhile, in the opposition, some say elections in Venezuela would ease the elimination of sanctions.
If free elections were held here, all foreign sanctions would blow over, but Maduro refuses to do so.
Nonetheless, socialists insist that neither the EU nor the US can judge what free elections are.
We have already had free elections guaranteed by many foreign observers, so the EU and the US are lying for political purposes.
Caracas slams the EU over violating international law with illegal sanctions. The expelling of the European ambassador is widely seen as a response to the bloc's economic policies against Venezuela. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
This is a specialized meeting on the latest studies on the coronavirus. Organized and hosted by Bacanyatullah University, the event brought together epidemiologists, virologists, and other medical experts to present their team's latest findings on prevention and treatment of COVID-19.
We tried the so-called plasmapheresis in treating COVID-19 patients. What is plasmapheresis? It's a method of removing blood plasma from the body and re-injecting it into the bloodstream. We conducted this method on 28 COVID patients, and it was effective so far. We need to gather a large sample to achieve more reliable results.
We conducted a single-centered retrospective observational study of 60 laboratory-confirmed COVID patients and administered low-dose prednisolone in combination with naproxen and lopinavir. This helped reduce the length of patients' hospitalization.
Since the pandemic broke out in Iran, Bagayatullah University has dedicated its R&D centers to COVID-related projects. So far, it has launched 200 research projects that seek to find a way to tackle the pandemic. Among them is a recombinant-based COVID vaccine that is making its way to the human trial phase.
We are wrapping up the animal trial stage and will soon begin the human trials of our vaccine. Our university has become a hotspot of major projects that center on COVID-19. We were amongst the first center that proposed plasma therapy for COVID-19. We're also conducting research on stem cell therapy and other viable treatments for the novel disease.
With the Bagayatullah vaccine, Iran now possesses three viable candidates that have made their way to the human trial. COVFARS, which is a recombinant vaccine, and COVIRAN, which works based on a weakened coronavirus. This, as Iran has already started its mass inoculation program using Russia's Sputnik V.
Bagayatullah Hospital has since day one been one of the most active places in the fight against COVID-19. Now as many biotech firms are concentrating their efforts on prevention and vaccine development, this center has also paid attention to treatment. Researchers here say they're very close to an effective COVID medicine. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Almost 1 year after the first positive case of COVID-19 was confirmed in Afghanistan, the country has now launched its first COVID-19 vaccination campaign. Representatives of medics, Afghan armed troops and journalists are the first ones who will receive doses of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine donated earlier this month by India.
Today I congratulate the people of Afghanistan on the launch of the first stage of COVID-19 vaccination. This is a big opportunity for the people of Afghanistan. I request all government bodies, media, and our religious scholars to cooperate with each other to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign smoothly.
Afghanistan received 500,000 doses of AstraZeneca's vaccine from the Serum Institute of India, which is producing the vaccine for mid- and low-income countries, earlier this month. The spread of COVID-19 in Afghanistan hardly hit the Afghan society due to mismanagement and lack of medical equipment. However, officials here say the government is committed to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign all over the country.
We don't expect any miracles. We need full collaboration of the entire society. So let's help this campaign to be implemented justly.
Taliban has announced its backing for the vaccination campaign. However, the inoculations comes amid relentless violence despite intra-Afghan talks. As official statistics estimate, up to 10 million Afghans that make nearly a third of the population might have been infected with the coronavirus. nearly 60,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and over 2,000 deaths have been recorded so far.
Afghan officials say the pandemic is still a serious problem for the country and urge health workers to vaccinate the whole nation in a fair and transparent manner. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The passage of time will never let the world forget the war crimes former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein committed against the innocent Iranian people. As part of its heinous crimes, the Iraqi dictator bombarded northwestern city of Sardash in 1978, killing 119 innocent civilians and exposing more than 8,000 to toxic gases, which maimed them forever. But Saddam was not alone in this 8-year war, and there were several countries, including Germany, France, the UK, and the US, that assisted him by arming his regime by chemical weapons. The Islamic Republic has always stressed that those complicit in Saddam's war crimes must be brought to justice. Therefore, in the presence of the country's top officials, an international conference was held in Tehran to look into the legal and international claims of the Islamic Republic in this regard.
Many countries gave Saddam intelligence, political, economic, military, and media support. All the world witnessed that these countries all stood against the great nation of Iran, but the United Nations could not play its role. The UN did not declare the Iraqi regime as the aggressor and the perpetrator of war. This is the question that the international community must ask the UN. Why the Security Council did not stop the aggressor from committing crimes against the Islamic Republic.
In the face of the chemical attacks, the international community turned down Tehran's frequent requests for deployment of experts for field investigations, something that Iran's foreign minister blasted during this event.
The Iraqi regime used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and non-civilians, and also the Iraqi people. In 6 or 7 reports by the United Nations, it was declared that the chemical weapons were first used against military forces and then civilians. But the United Nations does not have a good record in supporting international law, and during the imposed war, it did not even use the means to make power balance.
It was also stressed at this conference that the assassination of the former Iranian IRGC Quds Force Commander General Qasem Soleimani is top on the agenda to be followed up as part of this plan. Thinkers and researchers from 17 countries presented their papers on the legal aspects of the imposed war on Iran. These experts in both virtual and in-person methods elaborated on how the foreign countries helped Saddam's regime in killing civilians. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Delivering a speech at the 46th session of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro denounced the damaging effects of ongoing illegal sanctions by the U.S. and its allies against the Bolivarian Republic. Maduro outlined that Washington, following its regime change policy, leads a coalition of states that the European Union is part of, which is implementing a long series of punishing measures to deliberately bring about a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela and overthrow his administration. Maduro mentioned details of these measures.
Through illegal measures, Venezuela has been deprived of $30 billion in cash, which are part of the assets of the Republic abroad.
In this light, the socialist president strongly condemned the U.S. government and its allies over their abusive actions against the Venezuelan people.
Those who have taken away Venezuelan assets and resources have shown their cruelty, even worse at a time of a pandemic.
Although some opposition figures in Venezuela argued that the U.S. sanctions are a needed political tool to force anticipated elections in the Latin American country, legal analysts say that such sanctions are totally illegal and unacceptable.
What the U.S. is doing to our nation violates international law and all human rights instruments. There is no way to justify such a crime.
President Maduro denounced over 450 illegal sanctions U.S. and its allies imposed on Venezuela. Maduro pointed out that despite the massive economic aggression, his socialist government will not be overthrown. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
The Gaza Strip began its coronavirus vaccination campaign using the Russian Sputnik V vaccine. Medical workers will be the first to receive the jabs. The vaccination comes after long delays by the Israeli regime that only allowed a small shipment of the vaccine to reach Gaza last Thursday, after coming under heavy criticism by human rights organizations. Another shipment of the Russian vaccine arrived then through the Egyptian-controlled Rafah crossing on Sunday.
Today, we begin the vaccination of COVID-19 in the Gaza Strip, and God willing, we will be able to control the spread of the deadly virus and have herd immunity.
Nearly 55,000 people in the blockaded Gaza Strip have been infected with the coronavirus, mostly since late August 2020. Some 550 Gazans have also died of COVID-19.
The Gaza Strip is one of the most overpopulated areas in the world. Vaccination will play a major role in preventing the coronavirus pandemic and lowering the number of deaths in case we can manage to inoculate people as soon as possible. First doses would go to frontline medical workers, vulnerable patients, and the elderly.
Local authorities in the Gaza Strip struggled for months to lower the coronavirus infection rates through strict measures. The Israeli blockade has compounded the struggle of health workers in Gaza, undermining their efforts to contain and track the spread of the coronavirus.
This vaccination campaign is one of the main measures of the Ministry of Health to control the spread of this pandemic, along with other protocols. This vaccine will give immunity to those who receive it, and in turn will lower the number of daily infections.
Hundreds of Gazan patients have already lost their lives in recent years due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices under the watchful eye of the international community.
As vaccination begins in the blockaded enclave, experts say Tel Aviv must end its illegal policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing proper medical care. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
A few points about the Barjam, JCPOA, and the reductions in the commitments of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Another issue which is discussed frequently by officials, the people and politicians in cyberspace and in other podiums is the issue of the Barjam, JCPOA, and the Islamic Republic's commitments. Recently, the Islamic Republic announced that it has withdrawn from some of these commitments. Lately, it has also begun the 20-person enrichment process and the administration implemented the bill ratified by the Majlis. This is one of the issues that is discussed frequently today. I wish to raise two, three points about the issue of the Barjam. America's return to the Barjam. The first point is a discussion about whether the US should return to the Barjam or not. We do not at all insist on this, and we are in no rush for the US to return to it. Our issues is not at all if the US will return to that deal or not. Our reasonable and logical demand is the lifting of sanctions.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Sanctions should be lifted. This is a right that has been taken from the Iranian nation, whether by the US or the Europeans, who are tied to the US's apron strings and who follow that country. They're obliged to grant this right to the Iranian nation. Only if sanctions are lifted, will the US's return to the Barjam have a meaning. Of course, there's also the issue of compensations, which is one of our demands and which will be pursued in other phases and stages. However, if sanctions are not supposed to be lifted, then its return to the Barjam might even be to our disadvantage. Not only will it not be to our advantage, but it will also be to our disadvantage. Of course, I have told officials, both in executive and legislative branches, that they should move forward in a careful manner and by observing all the necessary steps. The second point is that the decision by the Majlis and the administration to cancel the Barjam commitments is the right decision. It is a completely reasonable, logical, and acceptable decision.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
European News Bulletin.
Here in London, news with me, Saeed Bourizza. A major development in this country today, and that has to do with the Supreme Court that has ruled that Shamima Begum, a 21-year-old woman who left the UK for Syria 6 years ago to join Daesh, should not be allowed back into the country to pursue an appeal against the removal of her British citizenship. Many argue that refusing to repatriate her could backfire, but the government insists she is a security risk. Bianca Rahimi tells us more.
In July 2020, the Court of Appeal ruled that Shamima Begum should be allowed to return to the UK to challenge her citizenship being revoked, saying it was, quote, the only way in which she can have a fair and effective appeal. But in November, the Home Office appealed against the decision, arguing it would create significant national security risks. Now the Supreme Court has ruled in the Home Office's favour, saying the right to a fair hearing does not trump other considerations.
The appropriate response to the problem in the present case is for the deprivation appeal to be stayed or postponed until Ms. Begum is in a position to play an effective part in it without public safety being compromised. That is not a perfect solution, as it's not known how long it may be before that is possible. But there is no perfect solution to a dilemma of the present kind.
In February 2015, at the age of 15, Shamima Begum left the UK for Syria. She was then found in 2019 in a Syrian refugee camp with other women and their children. The interviews that she gave made headline news and sparked heated debates. In what many called a publicity stunt, then Home Secretary Sajid Javid stripped Ms. Begum of her citizenship. Before the latest ruling, four British MPs wrote in the Telegraph that leaving British Daesh members in an ungoverned space would backfire on the UK.
If they are judged to be a risk, then all the more reason why they should be returned to Britain, where they can be processed by the British criminal justice system. Many of the people involved travelled to Syria as teenagers after being groomed online or trafficked by organised ISIS gangs.
France has outsourced its Daesh members' prosecutions to Iraq, where they have been given death sentences. The UK, the US, Ireland and Australia have stripped the accused of their citizenships. According to the Middle East Institute, this might be fueling future terrorist activity by sending the message that they are second-class citizens, particularly those with immigrant backgrounds. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Well, let's discuss that story with Ahmed Caballo. Ahmed, good to have you. So, what do you make of this decision made by the Supreme Court, which essentially, as we heard in our report, upholds the Home Office's argument that allowing her to return to the UK would, quote, create significant national security risk?
Yeah, it's worrying and it sets a dangerous precedent because the decision today wasn't about her British citizenship per se, but more about the right to a fair trial. Because they claim in the UK that the right to a fair trial is a cornerstone of any democracy and something the UK lambasts other nations around the world about. Yet the Supreme Court decided to overturn the Court of Appeal and said that the only way forward was to allow her to have her case while being in a refugee camp in northern Syria. Now, no one could argue that she could rightfully defend herself or appropriately defend herself from a refugee camp, which is most likely still controlled by the same elements that she was that she joined in the first place. Now, what's interesting about the decision is that it claims to be about national security, but if Shamim Begum returned to the UK, then she would most likely be monitored, she would be under house arrest, she'd be intensely watched, she'd have limited visitation rights. So in my opinion, it wasn't really about national security, but a political decision, because there was very little appetite to allow her back into the UK. And that the other real issue is that because of the relatively low conviction rate for fighters and their spouses who return to the UK, because the defence who represent these fighters are able to argue that the groups that these fighters join were also part of the same groups that have been supported by the British state itself, and therefore it wouldn't make sense to convict these fighters of crimes or fighting on behalf of a cause that the British state itself has supported.
All right, let's bring in race and ethnicity into the conversation as well. What role, if any, do you think those two facts, if you will, have played in the way that Shamima Begum has been treated by the government here?
I think it's played a massive role because if you're a British citizen from an ethnic minority background here in the UK, there is this perception that your citizenship is conditional and that if you criticise the British state, criticise British foreign policy, criticise British domestic policy such as policing, stop and search, then a common response is, why don't you go back to where you came from, negating the fact that if you are born in the UK, you are a British citizen. And I think this underpins the Shamim Begum case, because the idea is her citizenship was conditional, and therefore when she did something that the British public and British MPs and the British Home Office didn't like, then she no longer becomes a British citizen. But that negates the fact that British citizens commit heinous crimes abroad all the time. They are not stripped of their British citizenship. They're usually punished under the eyes of the law, and I think many people, legal observers, would argue that's what should have happened to Shamima Begum.
All right. Do you think that the British state perhaps, is trying to wash their hands off Shamima Begum and not trying to understand instead the reasons why a child born and raised in the UK, as you mentioned, could be radicalized enough to go and join a terrorist group halfway around the world.
Yes, certainly. I mean, she was groomed in the UK. Her school was notified. The British police knew what was happening, yet very little action was taken. And now, ultimately, many people are arguing that she has to take responsibility for her actions, but so should the British state in their failure to protect this young girl who left at the age of 15 to join Daesh. And that, yes, she should be punished. Yes, she should face the heavy hand of the law if she's found to have broken laws. But she should do that as a British citizen, because she committed those crimes as a British citizen. She was born and raised in the UK, and under international law, you cannot classify someone as stateless. And Bangladesh has stated very clearly that she's not a Bengali citizen.
She indeed is not. And also, that called into question the efficacy of the controversial so-called PREVENT program as well.
For sure, because if there are radicalization signs, then how could a 15-year-old get a passport and travel to a war zone? It shows that the PREVENT system or program isn't fit for purpose, and it isn't actually doing the very thing that it's designed to do, which is to stop the radicalization of young people and people in general in the UK. And I think there needs to be a further discussion about the role of the British state in supporting Takfiri militant groups in Syria, which has meant that there is a relatively low conviction rate for when these fighters come back. And that's the real issue. They're worried that the if Shamima Begum does return back to the UK, it's going to be very difficult to convict her while the UK has supported similar groups in Syria to overthrow Bashar al-Assad.
Right, thanks for your insight into the story, Ahmed Caballo there. Thank you. Moving on now. One person has died and four others have been wounded in a U.S. military air raid against anti-terror forces operating on the Iraqi-Syria border. The attack took place in the early hours of the morning in eastern Syria against Iraq's popular mobilization units, who have been fighting against the Takfiri Daesh terror group. Washington said that U.S. President Biden authorized the strikes in an attempt to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and Iraq. Russia has condemned the attack, which was the first of its kind under President Biden, labeling it dangerous and illegal. Staying with the Biden administration, it has said it'll soon reveal details of how it will take action against those responsible for the murder of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
He'd been very clear that the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, it was a horrific crime. That, of course, is going to be at the center of the report that we have been speaking to. This was enshrined in legislation that the administration should provide an unclassified version of the report to Congress.
The news comes days after The Guardian reported that U.S. President Joe Biden plans to release an unclassified intelligence report that will likely incriminate Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the brutal killing of Khashoggi. The long-awaited report is expected to strain U.S.-Saudi ties. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell has urged world leaders to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal.
I am convinced, as coordinator of the JCPOA, that we do have a diplomatic space, a diplomatic window of opportunity to dialogue at this moment and to reinvigorate this deal according with the wish explained and expressed by the new Biden administration. We need to use this opportunity and focus on solutions to bring the JCPOA back on track in order for everybody fulfilling their commitments. This is an occasion that we cannot miss.
Mr. Borrell was speaking at an EU meeting held in Brussels, which was attended by European leaders and NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. His comments come just days after Iran said that it would comply with its full JCPOA requirements once all signatories to the agreement show strict compliance as well. Greece and Austria are urging other EU states to adopt coronavirus vaccination passports, which they claim will help revive the struggling tourism industry whilst preventing the spread of the coronavirus. Leaders of the EU's 27 countries met online Thursday to start a two-day summit to discuss the ongoing pandemic and vaccination certificates. If approved, the vaccination passport would allow people who have been vaccinated with both jabs to travel within EU member states. In Greece, where tourism contributes to 25% of the annual GDP, global COVID-19 lockdown restrictions have destroyed the economy. Back in this country, Queen Elizabeth II of Britain has encouraged people living in the UK to, quote, think of others and get vaccinated against the coronavirus.
I think the other thing is that it is obviously difficult for people to, if they've never had a vaccine, because they ought to think about other people rather than themselves.
Her comments come after statistics reveal that 11 to 15% of British people were reluctant to get the COVID-19 vaccine, with many citing lack of trust in the authorities. So far, the UK has given more than 18 million people a first vaccine dose, with the government stating it plans to inoculate the rest of the population with their first jab by the summer. Over to Scotland now, where former First Minister Alex Salmond says the country's leadership has acted illegally and must be held to account. Today, he testified in Holyrood with inquiry into the SNP government's botched investigation of sexual harassment claims made against him. Mr. Salmond claims in its inquiry, the committee was systematically deprived of the evidence. He was later acquitted of 13 charges of sexual assault and awarded a payout of upwards of £500,000. But he says Nicola Sturgeon's government must explain why the case was handled so poorly. Have a listen.
The independence of the Crown Office as acting in the public interest matters. Acting in accordance with legal advice matters. Concealing evidence from the courts matters. The duty of candour of public authorities matters. Democratic accountability through Parliament matters.
There is not a shred of evidence that there was a conspiracy against Mr. Salmond and denies lying to Parliament. She is scheduled to appear before the committee to give evidence next Wednesday, and we'll be sure to cover that for you. To Italy now. The country has, for the first time in over 6 weeks, recorded its highest daily toll of COVID-19 cases. On Wednesday, Italy registered nearly 16,500 coronavirus cases, raising the country's known total cases to over 2.8 million. Thus far, the country has recorded nearly 97,000 deaths, the highest in Europe after the UK. The news comes just a day. Italian Health Minister Roberta Speranza announced that the country will not be relaxing its strict COVID-19 restrictions until at least April the 6th.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
In this segment, as we have been discussing, he has been president for just over a month, and Joe Biden has now ordered the first military strike of his presidency on, quote, Iranian-backed militia. Now, Washington claims the strike is a response to rocket attacks on U.S. forces in the region in the past 2 weeks. Joining me now to discuss all that, Richard Sudan. And Richard, bring us your take on that story.
I mean, I think it's quite extraordinary in many ways. You know, the sort of press releases and the talking points that are coming out of the Pentagon and Washington are framing this as some kind of retaliatory response, when I think, honestly, most sort of critical thinkers and serious political analysts understand that the United States is the most serious provocateur of violence in the region, not just in recent years, but actually over many, many decades. The U.S. has committed so many violations of sovereignty, so many violations of human rights, and so many war crimes, according to experts, that probably even the most serious mathematicians are probably struggling to keep count. And I think this is just kind of the latest in that series. And I think, you know, the other thing is, let's not forget, you had kind of many liberal pundits and many kind of media outlets across the world really kind of hailing President Joe Biden as some kind of libertarian. Many were making much of his so-called change in rhetoric, this kind of diplomatic tone that he was striking. And I think many people are now just going to see this as business as usual from the United States. You know, the United States' aggressive policy towards Syria and many other areas in the region simply is not going to change with the change of political, you know, office in the Oval Office. And I think, you know, these airstrikes are kind of just underscoring that reality. But I'm afraid I really don't see these as being the last, you know, airstrikes. These have been talked about as the first. And we're literally weeks, you know, into Joe Biden's presidency. So I think hopefully a lot of people would now kind of see the political reality for what it is. And I think also it's interesting that the United States, as it always does, has sought to blame Iran when most serious observers of Middle Eastern politics actually reviewed the Islamic Republic of Iran as having a massively stabilizing, you know, influence in the region. Were it not for...
Two things to be pointed out here. Number one, Iran denied any involvement in any attack on the U.S. forces that the Americans claim that happened recently. And secondly, it's always been the position of Iran that U.S. and by extension Western military interference in the Middle East region does not really lead to stability. And we have seen over the past decade, two decades I would say, and not even mentioning what happened prior to that, that it's gone from bad to worse. Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan are the most recent examples.
Most people would say these are the facts. You know, we've probably lost track of just how many terrorist groups, cells, and militias have been unleashed off the back of disastrous, failed, repeated policies from the US, of course, backed with their allies like the United States. But I think the reality is the situation in Syria, the situation in Palestine, and all across the region will be vastly different were it not for the stabilizing influence of Iran, which is actually welcomed and celebrated by many. So I think, actually, many people really see the claim by the US and the US government that Iran is somehow to blame for this as actually ludicrous. You know, the facts speak for themselves. Iran has not been involved in any wars against anybody. But it's the United States that is continually making excuse after excuse to go into other people's countries. Many people would say primarily to get resources. And of course, let's not forget that, you know, the arms industry, the war industry, is a massive, massive industry which rakes in billions and billions of dollars in profit each year. And so, you know, observers would say the United States needs to keep making excuses for meddling in other countries. And in this case, we're talking about airstrikes in Syria. But, you know, Saeed, I think more and more people are starting really to cotton on to the kind of reality of the situation.
Bring us some of the reaction to this story online.
And there have been many. Let's go first to Danny, who says, Biden has bombed Syria, blaming it on an Iranian-backed militia targeting military hardware in Iraq. Could it be that the people of the region want the U.S. occupiers to leave? Biden's rule will be riddled with war crimes, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. Birthday Sprinkle says President Biden bombed Syria before Americans got COVID relief payments, and it's not even surprising. And Tanner Jones tweeted, Joe Biden just bombed Syria, so I think now is a good time to say again that the U.S. should not be in the Middle East at all. And there's many reactions like this online at the moment, Saeed.
All right, Richard, let's move on to your second story. And while we're still in Syria, we're going to revisit a story I discussed with Ahmed Caballo earlier on in the broadcast. Tell us how social media users have reacted to today's ruling by the British Supreme Court on the case of Shamima Begum.
Well, I think it's really hard to overstate the significance of this case, which really isn't about Shamima Begum herself. This is about a much wider issue. And I think one of the primary points here for many people is that, you know, Britain calls itself a democracy. Many people say it's the kind of mother of democracies. But Shamima Begum was basically tried in the media and by right-wing populism before she even had her day in court. Now, no one is saying that Shamima Begum shouldn't be held accountable for her actions. but, you know, the United Kingdom, and again, this is not me, this is legal observers and legal experts saying this, the United Kingdom cannot simply render people stateless for politically expedient reasons. It simply cannot be the case. Now, I dare say this decision will probably be appealed, but I think what's astonishing for a lot of people is that the justification given for this is that Shamima Begum somehow presents a national security threat. This is a 21-year-old woman who left the country when she was 15 years old. It's not like she went to join Daesh as a fighter. She married a Daesh fighter, and I think it's ridiculous that she now constitutes some kind of serious threat to national security when we see many other umpteen examples of people that have been involved in wars involving terrorism, people would say. And not only that, I think year after year, the United Kingdom basically rolls out the red carpet to all sorts of arms dealers involved in very real war crimes abroad. And actually other leaders, for example, the Israeli leaders are welcomed here, you know, with red carpets. So I think this is really about a much wider issue, much wider, way beyond Shamima Begum. And as I think Ahmed Caballo said, this certainly sets a dangerous precedent. But again, a lot of legal experts are basically agreeing with that point. And
Richard,
I think
let me get your opinion on this point briefly as well. Some are calling this ruling, this whole treatment of Shamima Begum, as a cynical distraction from a failed counterterror strategy. Very briefly, what do you think of that?
Well, I think even if it isn't a direct ploy to do that, it will certainly have that effect. And by the way, it won't just divert attention from a failed, kind of a foreign policy strategy. It will divert from a whole host of other problems in the United Kingdom. I think one of the points here is everyone's focusing on Shamima Begum. I think many more people are actually saying, look, what is the UK's role, or what was the UK's role in actually bringing about the emergence of Daesh? Many people are saying that the United Kingdom and her allies, through failed foreign policies, have created the fertile breeding ground which allows terror groups like Daesh to flourish. And so if that hadn't happened, there would have been no Daesh for Shamima Begum to go to in 2015. So I think
that
all of this really diverts responsibility
point,
from the United Kingdom.
Indeed. Let's hear from people out there who have been watching this story.
So Trevor tweets, Andrew Mitchell, the journalist, is correct. Of course, Shamima Begum and the other British nationals should be returned to the UK and their citizenship restored. They are nationals and should be tried in the UK. Gary Young, the journalist, tweets an old article of his on the subject, which says, the notion that Britain could not handle Shamima Begum, could not show her a better future, could not try her, convict her, reorient her, or support her, is worse than pathetic. And Dragon tweets, Shamima Begum was an actual child when she was groomed and radicalized. The decision to strip her of her citizenship is so wrong, and I wonder how different it would be if she was white. And Dragon's not the only person to make that final point there, Saeed.
All right, Richard, Sudan, Richard, thanks for all that. Our time is literally up. Thanks for joining us again.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. The limelight.
Iran has condemned as a flagrant violation of human rights and international law the illegal and aggressive attacks by American terrorist forces on various regions of eastern Syria. In a statement on Friday night, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh stressed that such attacks against Syria were a continuation of the Israeli regime's unabated aggression against the Arab country. We now present you an article written by staff writers of Press TV's website. The piece is titled, Bad Sign from Biden Administration, Syria Slams Fatal U.S. Raid on Iraq Border. Please stay with us for more. government in Damascus has censured the United States air raid against positions of Iraqi counterterrorism forces on the Iraq-Syria border, which martyred one and wounded four others, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of new U.S. President Joe Biden. In a statement by Syria's official Sana'a News Agency on Friday, 26th of February, the Syrian Foreign Ministry said Syria strongly condemns the American act of aggression in the early hours of the day on facilities used by forces of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, PMUs, better known as Hashd al-Shaabi, at a border point in Syria's eastern Deir al-Zor province. The statement said, in a flagrant violation of the rules of international law and Charter of the United Nations, U.S. warplanes on Thursday, 25th of February, launched a cowardly aggression by bombing some areas in Deir al-Zor province near the Syria-Iraq border. The statement added, it is a bad sign regarding the policies of the new U.S. administration, which should adhere to international laws and norms. The military action, the first of its kind under U.S. President Joe Biden, has been met with a negative reaction, with many observers likening Biden's approach to that of his hawkish predecessor Donald Trump. Iraqi resistance forces have been fighting remnants of the Takfiri Daesh terrorist group across border regions of Iraq and Syria in coordination with the government in Damascus. An informed source said that one person had lost his life and four others had been injured in the U.S. military's act of aggression. In a statement issued after the attack, Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said the raid authorized by President Biden had been deliberate and meant to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and in Iraq. America's defense secretary also thanked Baghdad for helping with what he called intelligence input in a claim that surprised the Iraqi government. The Iraqi defense ministry denied the claim in a statement and said Baghdad's cooperation with U.S.-led military coalition is restricted to fighting terrorism and averting threats against Iraq in a way that the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity would remain unharmed. Military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and American military forces in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on Iraqi resistance groups. In the latest such attacks, rockets hit Baghdad's Green Zone, which houses the U.S. Embassy, and other missions recently. The American military base in Erbil had similarly been attacked just days earlier. However, the Iraqi resistance groups and many Iraqi officials have roundly dismissed Washington's allegations, blaming rogue elements for the attack. There has been a sharp rise in attacks on U.S. military bases and diplomatic missions in Iraq since early last year, after the Iraqi parliament passed a law urging the withdrawal of all U.S. occupying forces from Iraq, amid widespread anger over Washington's assassination of top Iranian anti-terrorist commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and the deputy commander of the Popular Mobilization Units of Iraq, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandes. The Americans tried to link the raids on their positions to Tehran's pledge to extract revenge for Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani's murder. However, the Islamic Republic says it will not hide its act of revenge whenever it decides to go for it, just like what it did in the case of the retaliatory missile raid on the U.S.-run Ain al-Assad air base in western Iraq. Analysts say the attacks on U.S. positions in Iraq, which usually cause almost no damage to the targets, are meant to serve as a pretext for the U.S. to keep its terrorist forces in the country. In turn, Faiz al-Ahmad, the head of the Syrian Parliament's Committee on National Security, strongly condemned the U.S. airstrikes, which targeted positions of the Syrian